All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is the WTF podcast. Welcome to it. How you holding up? Are you all right? Are you keeping it together? Just take a breath. Just take a breath. No, it doesn't matter where you are. If you're in your car, if you're on the treadmill, if you're climbing Everest, well, don't go crazy with the breath. I know how that goes. And also, get down. Just get the fuck down. Seriously. Turn around and go. It's not worth it. Just pretend like you made it. Make it in your mind. Climb Everest in your head and consider yourself victorious. Do that. That's self-empowering. What's happening? I am happy to say that I got James Hetfield from Metallica here. Metallica. Honestly, I was not teenage during the rise and reign of Metallica. So my knowledge and connection was not one of whose post-pubescent years were altered by Metallica. I did not have Metallica coursing through my cock as it moved into the world. But, you know, I did take it in. I'll explain a little bit my relation with Metallica in a second. I do want to bring it to everyone's attention that I will be touring. Some of you know that. I've got a lot of tour dates coming up in January, February, March, and April, mostly in February, March, and April. I will be in Tallahassee, Florida at the Ruby Diamond Concert Hall on January 24th. I'll be at the Carolina Theater in Durham February 17th, the Knight Theater in Charlotte February 18th. I'll be at the Ridgefield Playhouse in Ridgefield, Connecticut, March 2nd, the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, March 3rd, Olympia de Montreal in Montreal, Quebec, March 4th, the Danforth Music Hall in Toronto, Ontario, that's sold out on March 5th, College Street Music Hall in New Haven, March 10th, Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, March 11th, Flynn Center in Burlington, Vermont, March 12th, I'll be in Oakland at the Fox Oakland, March 24th, I'll be at the Moore Theater in Seattle. March 25th, I'll be at the Vogue Theater in Vancouver. On March 26th, Paramount Theater, Austin, Texas. March 31st, Boulder Theater, Boulder, Colorado, April 7th. Paramount Theater in Denver, Colorado, April 8th. Aladdin Theater in Portland, Oregon on April 21st. Aladdin Theater in Portland, Oregon again on April 22nd. I'll be at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee on the 27th of April. The Orpheum in Madison, April 28th. The Pantages in Minneapolis on the 29th. Two shows at the Pantages. I believe we're shooting a special there. I'll be at the Miriam Theater in Philly, May 12th, and the Warner Theater in D.C. on May 13th. Woo, doggy! And those are all the dates. If I didn't get to your city this tour, get to one of the cities I mentioned, because I don't know how much longer. I don't know when the next tour will be. Because I'm going to lay back and put shit together at my own pace. Tired of rushing. There's no struggle. There will be a struggle, but it's not with me. Yeah, so this will be the last tour for a while. I'll be doing dates here and there. But, and I'll get out. You know, I say these things. I'm being dramatic. But I do want some downtime to sort through stuff. Because I'll tell you, these last couple of weeks, aside from mentally preparing for the tremendous shift in the fabric of the country and the world that happens this month, I've enjoyed the downtime to sort of like regroup, dig into my own life, you know, figure out where I stand, watch some compelling, informative documentaries, read some books, sort through shit. I just watched Adam Curtis's earlier doc, The Century of the Self, which was, again, a nice preface to the new one, Hypernormalization, which has really shifted my perception. And also, as bleak as it all is, it's very relieving how much of it was seemingly out of my control personally. I think balls were dropped, but not necessarily mine directly. And perhaps with the new perception, we can move forward with open eyes a bit. I regret to say, because I know a lot of you hold on to these expectations. I regret to say there'll be no guitar playing at the end of today's show because I've injured myself. I've lopped off a piece of my finger. That's the price you pay for getting a new knife for Christmas. All my knives are just dull enough not to slice a piece of my fucking finger off. So I was gifted this beautiful big new knife, and I was excited about it because I enjoy a sharp knife, but I think ultimately I'd gotten used to my semi-sharp knives, and I wasn't afraid of them, or did I think twice about them? They were sharp enough, but I had surrendered to the idea that these were the knives I've been given. But someone sent me a new knife, and the other day I was cutting through some tofu and cutting them into cubes so I could fry them up a bit for my girl Sarah, who's a veggie, and I eat better when I date vegetarians. That's not why I'm dating her. And I slice down, and you know that first ping, that little like, ooh, that's a bad feeling on my skin. But you know exactly what that feeling is. It's not pain at first. It's just, I've cut my finger. How bad is it? You have no idea until you pull it out and there's blood going all over a big chunk of tofu. Bloody tofu. That's not on the menu. And I look at it. And look, I've been in the restaurant game. I did my time in delis. I did my time as a short order cook. I sliced through my fucking thumb cutting a bagel, needed 4 stitches. I've lopped off the tip of that same thumb on a slicer, not paying attention, moving through some roast beef. Yeah, I've had to wrap the bloody restaurant rag washcloth around my hand as I was driven to the hospital with my hand out the window, elevated up like some sort of bloody turn signal. I've been there. I've been through those restaurant wars when I was a younger man. So I was familiar with the situation. So I pulled my finger out. Blood's coming out of it. And there was a flap. Just a flap on my pointer finger. Just a flap of skin. Nice little circle. Just lopped off a little, just a tip with prints and everything. Just gushing blood. Sarah's getting nauseous. Got to clean it out. Dump some peroxide on it. The flap is barely holding on. You don't know what to do in that moment because you know, those of you who've been through this, I'm going to walk you through it, that if you lop a piece of your finger off, if you don't try to salvage the flap of skin or however much finger you cut off, then you've got that weird open raw thing that's got a scab down below the nerves, and it's tedious and very sensitive for a long time. So you want to try to save that flap. I knew I couldn't get it stitched on because if I would have went to the emergency room, I would have waited, would have cost me some bread, and they would have said, we're not going to stitch it. We're just going to cut that shit off and put some goo on top of it and dress it. So I'm thinking, we're going to save it, man. We're going to save that flap. So I put it on, peroxide it, cleaned it out, put some Neosporin, gauzed it up, and I've been gauze dressing it twice a day, and I think the flap is taking. And that's going to be the name of my new CD. But I think the flap is taking, and I'm just amazed and obsessed with the miracles of the human body. I hope it takes. It hasn't turned black, hasn't dried up, hasn't fallen off. It's a perfect little circle on the tip of my finger, and I'm just keeping it dressed, and I'm not fucking ramming it into anything. And I'll be so proud of my skin if it takes. James Hetfield, Metallica. I got the opportunity to talk to him. He was out making the rounds. I was happy to talk to him, but nervous as I usually am when you talk to a recording artist that has many records out. You may know a couple, but depending on your fanness. I knew, obviously, Metallica. I know some Metallica records. I listened to the new record. I enjoyed it because most Metallica stuff I'm coming to with fresh ears. I went through their whole catalog. I tracked the evolution, but again, my dick wasn't into it. Like I wasn't, you know, it did not interface with my rage complex. When I was younger, my rage was not as defined. And, I was sort of, a blues-based brain. AC/DC was my metal guy. And I don't know if they're metal. I'd consider them more hard rock, but AC/DC, they were them. But I was not specifically metal. You know, metal is metal. I mean, when I was in high school, Judas Priest was around, but I didn't lock in. I wasn't locked in. It didn't integrate with my teenage sexual frustration and general angst. So I did not have that emotional, visceral connection to the music of Metallica. So I came to it all with open mind and open heart, and I enjoyed it, and I love the new record. But it's interesting, because I I inherited all these records. I told you about that woman, Kristen, who gave me her dad's records. Well, I've been going through them. Some of them I had, some of them I didn't need, some of them I hadn't heard in a while, some of them were completely new to me. But point is, a lot of Jethro Tull. I mean, like a lot of Jethro Tull. Now, look, I'll be honest with you. I saw Tull when I was in high school, I believe, in Albuquerque. I remember because we went and my buddy Chris tried to smuggle a half pint or a pint of Southern Comfort in his sock. And we got it in. And then when we jumped the guardrail to get down into the pit from the outside seats, the grandstand seats, the bottle broke and cut his leg open. I don't remember what happened after that, but I do remember that happened. I don't think we went to the hospital, but it was not a good situation. But I think Southern Comfort has curative powers, both as a drink, an anesthetic, and also as an antiseptic cleanser of wounds. So I did see Tull. Tull did not stay with me. But since I had all these records, I was listening to some Tull. I listened to Aqualung. I listened to Benefit. I listened to Living in the Past because I had these records. And it was weird because there's a couple of songs on Aqualung that I think that Metallica could cover. There was a tonal similarity. So I was able to track some of the hard rock, hard metal roots, especially the way Metallica does it, where you're moving through, you know, slower songs, more ballad. Not, they're not ballad, but they're definitely slow and thoughtful. Even the singing a little bit. I didn't bring this up with Hetfield because it happened after I talked to him. My second wife, Mishnah, was a complete fucking metalhead. So I went through 8 years of that. I mean, we had in our house, there was a room and a full shelf dedicated to metal action figures, Ozzy Osbourne, Metallica. There was a lot of metal in the house at that time. So I don't know if I grew to appreciate it then or resent it, but it was around. What I'm saying is I'm open. Metallica's good music and the new record is good. And I was excited to talk to Mr. Hetfield. And the new record is called Hardwired to Self-Destruct. It's out now. And this is me and James talking. Are you good? Is it good in your head?
Is what good in my head?
Anything?
Anything good in
is
my head?
Is there anything good in your head?
Yeah, sounds good.
I mean, I lived in the Bay Area, and you guys are very, or you were at least, very present socially in the Bay Area. Like, I knew people that were like, oh, yeah, Lars's house. Like, you know, people had stories about this or that.
Uh-huh.
And, but you didn't, you're not indigenous to the Bay Area. You're from here.
Yeah, I grew up in Downey.
Now, what is out in Downey?
Right now?
But like when you grew up, I have a hard time picturing it because I think I talked to, you know, Dave Alvin and Phil Alvin. They came from the outskirts somewhere, but I have no sense of what the outskirts of Los Angeles are.
Yeah, Downey is, gosh, when I was growing up, it was basically, it was kind of suburbia.
Yeah.
You know, there was the mall down the street and it was a great place to grow up.
The mall.
Cool neighborhood. I could walk to or ride my bike to every school.
Right.
You know, elementary, middle school, high school.
Just American towny land.
Pretty much. I think I right now there is somewhere a poster or something written on like one of these big electrical boxes that are on the corners.
Yeah.
It's the home of James Hetfield and on the other side, and the Carpenters. So there you go.
They must have switched it at some point.
Yeah, they're like, I think they did.
Yeah.
Yes. The Carpenters were definitely bigger news than me, for sure.
A little while ago. Not anymore. You beat them out. That's so, weird.
Finally.
They came from there too?
Yeah, they did. I remember growing up, and we would drive to church. And on the way there, there was a close to me, and gosh, I can't remember what. But there were the names of the condo apartment buildings that they owned.
Oh.
So the Carpenters owned some apartments.
So they had business.
There.
They were business people.
They
small
were.
Business owners in Downey.
They were thinking ahead.
Real estate people.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think the brother's still alive.
I think so.
There was. Did you ever hear that movie, the Karen Carpenter story that was done by Todd Haynes with just Barbie dolls? It's great. It's a genius. It doesn't matter. So Downey, you're on your way to church. You drive by the condos. What kind of church?
Christian Science.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So driving there, and I thought, you know, oh, wow, the Carpenters, they own apartments?
Yeah.
They've made it.
Yeah.
I got to beat them out on an electrical box at some point.
Yeah, yeah. And you did it. You did it.
I did.
Now, like Christian Scientist, that's, what's her name, Eddie? Is that her, what's the
woman? Mary Baker Eddy. Yep.
That's a big, mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in Boston, and they had a big Christian Scientist thing there. And
yeah. It's a interesting concept.
My did parents, you get out of it?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. And yeah, I mean, you know, did you get out of it? Was it a cult? Yes, it was a cult.
Well, they're all cults, man.
Yeah. I was.
Some cults are better than others.
I agree.
You know
I
what
agree.
I mean? They can work. Yeah. You know what I mean? If you're not hurting anybody.
Hey, the Metallica cult is doing well, alive and well right now, man.
Sure is, man. that new record is like, it's great.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, it's really great. And I, you know, it's like, I haven't followed you the whole way. And like, we're like the exact same age. So when I was in high school, you know, we were listening to different things. But I think that like a lot of times I would imagine with Metallica that a lot of your fans start when they're in high school.
I'd imagine so.
Right.
They're just pissed sort of off. They're
exactly.
pissed off and hate life and wish they were somewhere else.
Well, the weird thing about this record was that I'm listening to it like recently. And as a grown person, a grown-up man who wasn't programmed by the Metallica cult in high school, I was like, holy shit. You're going to get me. I was like, this is good fucking rock. I mean, I was like, I was all in the whole time, all the way through.
Nice.
And then I listened to most of your catalog in the last 3 days. So I've witnessed the whole evolution of you and the fellas. Like in like 78 hours.
You're brave.
Well, it was just interesting to hear you singing on the first three records. And then at some point, he's like, there's the voice.
Yeah.
You know, can
his
you
balls listen? Dropped. Wow. Or at least one of them did.
Can you hear
one
that?
Of the three.
Can you listen to that stuff?
I have to. It's on the radio. I mean, I don't have to listen to
but
it.
Like but like the really old stuff, like the first three records.
Well,
do you ever go back?
I don't particularly put them on, but if we're rehearsing a song that we haven't played in a long time, you know, I'll go back and listen to it. Or, gosh, all right, hockey fans, San Jose Sharks, we go to the Shark Tank and watch the Sharks play. Seek and Destroy is their, you know, skating out music.
Yeah.
And I can't believe, it's like, are you kidding me? This is horrible. This sounds terrible. Get a remixed version. Come on.
You should just give it to them. Show up and give it to them.
Skating the scene. You know, it's this little kid, man.
Maybe you should fucking do one specifically for them.
That's a good idea. We should.
So when did you start?
Singing?
You know, well,
no. Finally.
No. I kind of hear it. It's like the fourth album, right?
Yeah, kind of.
where do you consider it happening?
I think the Black Album. I don't know. It's all singing. It's all me. And it's exactly where I was, you know? And that's as good as I could do back then. And this is as good as I can do now. And who knows?
Well, I think that's what makes it such a unique voice is that you're just, you know, you're not trying to be anything else. You're just figuring it out, right?
Exactly. That's kind of what I do everywhere. Even right now, I'm thinking out loud and sometimes it works.
Keep
sometimes
going.
It doesn't.
Keep going. I thought the three ball thing was very good. It was a nice riff. It was good. But how do you get from like, you know, driving around in a car in Downey? Like when does the shit switch in your head where rock and roll becomes essential? Like when did you start, you know, waking up to the power of rock to make you feel better?
Right. Well, that's an easy memory for me to access.
Really?
It was freshman, well, it was the beginning of sophomore year at Downey High when I showed up for football practice again.
Yeah.
You know, I'd been on the freshman team, showed up in the summer to start, you know, rehearsing.
Yeah.
To start practice.
Getting the act together.
And I showed up and I had long hair.
Yeah.
And the coach just said, hey, yeah, you know, you're going to have that cut, you know, by next week.
Yeah.
I said, why? Like, well, because it's sticking out of your helmet, you know. It's like, oh, that's the limit right there, the helmet, you know. And it's like, yeah, but I'm playing in a band and I like music. And it's like, well, you can't do that. So I never came back. That was it.
Fuck you.
Yeah. In my head, yeah. I still had to graduate.
But, right. You made
know,
a quiet
sophomore
choice.
Year. A quiet fuck you. And just got into music. That was it. My brother, I have two older half brothers. 10 years older than I. So
oh, really?
They had music. They were in bands.
Whose kids were they? Your mom's?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same mom. So my brother was in a band called The Bitter End. And they were, you know, they had like purple and black suits all matching and big thick belts. And they were playing, you know, Jimi Hendrix covers and,
oh, yeah,
and stuff
was
like that.
Was he a guitar player?
Drummer.
Oh, he was a drummer.
Drummer.
So yeah. No guitars in the house.
There was guitars in the house. There was a piano. There was a drum kit. So I'm eventually going to play drums.
Really? That's what you're moving towards? That's
well, this is hot news right
breaking
now.
News?
I've never told anyone, but yeah, I'm working on being a drummer at some point.
Are you really?
Yeah. And Lars wants to sing, so it's a good trade.
Yeah. So that'll be a more relaxed
not
album.
Not for the listener, but good trade for us.
Have you tried it?
Drums?
No, I love. I mean, like, have you switched up in the studio?
Yeah, we have.
In the studio?
Yeah. Well, we did it live.
Yeah.
We in concert.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a song called Am I Evil that's not the most difficult song to play. So we would just switch up, you know?
Yeah.
And Kirk could play bass and, you know, we would just switch the whole thing up.
What else does Lars play?
Nothing. He just ran around and he was like a madman. It's so funny.
Cause a lot of madmen. Robert's kind of a madman too.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, Lars wanting to be the, you know, front man.
Oh,
I don't want a guitar. I just run around.
Yeah.
And dude, by the end of the first verse, he was winded because he ran all over the place. He was trying to be like a Bruce Dickinson or something, jumping off everything and doing the splits and And then he
had to take a rest. He had to take a break.
Well, I think that was his fantasy in, you know, a 5-minute song, and then he was done.
Yeah, got it out of his system.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
So your brother was playing Hendrix covers, wearing the matching outfits and stuff. When did you start learning how to play music?
Well, I think I fiddled around with it when I was a kid just because the instruments were around.
Who played guitar in the house?
My older brother.
Oh,
he had it was pretty much just an acoustic guitar.
Uh-huh.
But, you know.
Not the drummer brother, the other one?
Yeah, Chris is his name. David, the younger brother. He was in a band, and they would rehearse in our garage, and they weren't supposed to. And one of those things where, you know, okay, the parents are gone. He's calling everyone up. Come on over. We're going to jam. And then and I go out there, and wow.
Yeah.
And just everything about it, the noise, the fact that they weren't supposed to be doing it.
Was there a couple of smoking girls sitting around watching?
I don't remember that part.
Because he was always like in the rehearsal space. There's always like one or two chicks. Just like yeah,
oh, it's just a friend of ours, Jim down the street. Our first groupie.
You don't remember that part?
I don't remember that part, but I'm sure that came in soon after that. But, you know, the whole, just the smell.
Yeah.
The smell of the amps, the smell of the tubes cooking.
Yeah.
There was something exciting about, you know, the leather on the amp or the vinyl,
the gear
baking, the gear smelled, and then, you know, parents coming home soon, everyone get out of here, and then
scrambling with equipment.
Yep. And then they'd, you know, hey, what are you guys doing? And I'd, hey, Eddie, let me play his guitar. And I played the keyboards. They're like, what?
You blew it.
Yeah, my brother's like, dummy. Oh, sorry.
So that was like right when he started to get, did you take lessons?
I took piano lessons after that. You know, I think what had happened is we had a piano in the house, but I wanted to play drums. So I'm just banging on the piano, doing rhythms.
Right.
And they thought, oh, he's a piano player. He wants to play piano. So I took that for 3 years in elementary school and hated almost every minute of
that
it.
That probably helped, though, right?
Oh,
in
it
retrospect?
Totally helped. I am super grateful that my mom thought to, hey, let's do that. It was at, you know, some old lady's house. And
right.
It stunk and it, you know. Cookies at the end was definitely the best part.
But you learned how to read music?
Yep. Learned how to read music.
Classical shit?
Yep.
Yeah, because that plays in, man.
Well, left and right hand doing different stuff and singing. So there's like three things going on. So there's no doubt that helped me with my ear, and it helped me with, you know, just being able to sing and play at the same time.
And some of this stuff, like structurally, it seems is not like, you know, you're not like a traditional kind of blues-based band.
No.
It seems like you kind of like, you know, you get around that, and it seems like it's almost classical sometimes.
Right. It's definitely machinery and classical kind of together. I think, like you said, the piano has, you know, different voicings and layers and stuff, and it's not just stripped down blues at all.
Yeah.
You know, we messed around with that for a little while, but, you know, always felt a little orchestral, you know?
Yeah.
Orchestral even.
Yeah, because I noticed, like, and it's interesting too, like, and maybe I'm being crazy because, like, I don't have the whole catalog in my head, but this record, the new record, because I'm like a, you know, I'm more of a, you know, a hard rock guy than, you know, than I am like a thrash metal guy. Mm-hmm. But like, it seems like there's, like, you open up with the fucking, you know, right away. But then, like, it seems like there's a little more space with some of this shit.
Mm-hmm.
Am I wrong? Like, it seemed like you guys were, like, Kirk and you were doing, like, it wasn't, it seemed like some of the licks actually had some air to them, mm-hmm. like, almost bluesy. Is that wrong for me to say?
No, no. Dude, you're listening to music. You can't listen to it wrong.
Right, I mean, but was that intentional? Was it, like, do you feel like you're more relaxed?
I think so. I mean, after 35 years of doing what we're doing, we're pretty confident in what...
yeah.
We're getting better, you know? We're kind of carving our own sound out, you know?
Still.
Still. But I think, like what you said about, you know, you open up, just bash them in the face.
Yeah.
And then hit them with some melody and then come back. And just when they think they're safe, yeah. boom, again.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Dynamics have always been a big part for us.
Yeah.
And so when we did, for instance, we did the S&M album with the symphony in the Bay Area, that was like the ultimate like power trip where we felt, you know, well, the passion that we share here is the power of music and building and coming back down and dynamics. And
yeah.
So
that must have been exciting.
Oh, super.
Full
super
orchestra?
Amazing.
Yeah. Did you do it at, where was it recorded? Symphony Hall?
It was, we tried it in San Francisco. It was, we were a little too loud for that place for some reason.
Yeah.
You know, basically a lot of the symphony halls are designed acoustically for acoustic instruments.
Yeah, nice wooden things.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Strings and some horns.
So we did it in Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
And it came out quite awesome. And a little side note, interesting thing, the artist Skrillex, who was somewhat popular, he was in the audience at that gig. And he's in the video. He's got blonde hair back then, and he was the kid that's trying to stage dive.
Really?
Stage dive at the symphony.
So you're plinking around on the piano with an old lady eating cookies.
Yeah, that's right.
And then, like, at what point do you find, what were you listening to that started to make you want to play in a band?
Well, guitar, you know, I realized pretty quickly that if I wanted to be in a band, you know, a upright piano is not going to call, you know, I can't push that around. I can't jump around. I can't do the stuff I want to be the guys in the poster that I had in my room.
Which,
you know,
guys?
Which I had Aerosmith. I had, you know,
Steve, yeah.
There was a particular poster, Steven Tyler and Joe Perry together on one microphone.
Sure.
And I thought, wow, I don't know who I want to be. They were both so cool.
Yeah.
And so I kind of ended up being both in a way, singing and playing.
Yeah.
Well, 78 is when it really kicked in. Well, it was earlier than that. You know, me and my buddy growing up in the Downey area, we kind of both picked up the guitar at the same time.
Yeah.
And we would push each other.
Yeah.
You know, hey, I show up at school. Hey, I learned this. And then he'd go, yeah, but I got this. Like, oh, damn.
Yeah.
And he'd go back and, okay.
Yeah.
Like this total healthy competition of building each other up. And
what happened to that guy?
What happened? We had a falling out. It was terrible.
Over a lick?
Pretty much. It wasn't a girl. It wasn't a car. It wasn't anything. It was like, who's better?
Right.
I think that's what it was.
Fuck you, man.
There was another guy that came in and, you know, it's always... when you get a triangulated relationship, screws it all up.
Oh, yeah.
He says he's better than you, and then you say better than him, and they started a fight, and then
that was it.
Stupid.
Yeah. So, like, Aerosmith, though, like, when that first fucking Aerosmith record, I listened to that recently. It's so good, man.
Yeah.
So dirty.
It's pretty raw and dirty,
and
that's what I liked about them. And my buddy, who I was talking about, John was his name.
Yeah.
He loved Kiss, and he liked Alice Cooper, so it was all the makeup kind of thing. And I loved this, the raw,
Nugent
and Aerosmith.
I never liked the makeup.
Yeah.
Not much. I went and saw, like, Rush. Remember, they were huge when we were in high school, right?
Oh, yeah.
Who'd you see in high school?
Well, I think my first concert my brother took me to, it was, The first concert, ironically for me, was Jethro Tull.
Yeah.
And Uriah Heep opening.
Yeah.
1978.
A little prog rock for you.
And then soon after that, it was, you know, I'm all about Aerosmith. So he got tickets. It was Aerosmith and AC/DC.
Holy shit. 78?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, my God.
So I saw Bon Scott, and I didn't even really realize it.
I did, too,
later.
With Journey. Yeah.
Nice.
And I was there to see Journey.
Yep.
It's fucked right. up. Like, in retrospect, I'm like, I fucking can't believe that I was that guy.
Yeah.
My buddy, and I think that I talked to the bass player of Journey, and he said that they were opening for AC/DC, but I didn't remember it like that. I remember, like, watching Bon and being like, what the fuck is this? Yeah. And then Journey comes on, like, I've admitted it publicly, but I have a hard time admitting it publicly.
Well, good for you. It's okay, man.
How great is fucking Angus on guitar?
He's awesome. And, you know, when people talk about us and our longevity, they're always saying, you know, so how long are you going to go? And you're going to be in your wheelchair and blah, blah, blah. And you know, be like the Rolling Stones. Like, well, okay. I kind of get that. I get the reference to the Rolling Stones, but you know, for us, we're a little more athletic, a little more, I mean, fast songs, I mean, really intense.
Yeah.
So I say, you know, hey, look at Angus. All right.
Yeah.
If that guy's up there and is, God, I don't know how old he is now, hundred years old, but he is unbelievable.
How old is he? I'm 53. You're a month older than me. And so he's got to be 60, right? Got to be.
At least. Yeah. And he's up there just going, I mean, I don't know how he sweats so much. There's nothing to him, you know?
Yeah. Have you played with them?
Yes, we did. We did some shows with them, and they're unbelievable.
Yeah.
They're friggin' powerful, and you think, okay, this is the best song. This is my favorite song of theirs.
And then
the next one comes like, oh my God, I forgot that. And the whole crowd is singing every word, and it's just, what a great, great live band.
Now, but like right around the time, it seems that the drive of what you were doing with the early Metallica stuff, I mean, that's like, you know, that was happening in punk rock music, but you seem like your tastes were pretty mainstream, like with me. So when did that stuff start to enter the world?
Yeah.
Because we were up against disco too. If you were a sophomore the same time I was, like there was that moment where we had all the old guys, we had Zeppelin and Aerosmith and AC/DC's first couple of records. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, disco had to be killed.
That was the main objective.
Right.
Kill disco.
It was kind
of. Let's join up all the other kinds of music and let's kill this stuff right away.
True. And then like new wave came in before punk kind of, you know, in like suburbia, like all of a sudden the Knacks record and then all of a sudden the Sex Pistols or whatever and then American punk. But like it was a real problem.
Right. Well, I totally agree. And I remember that specifically to the degree that in my, I guess my high school yearbook, there, you know, put your quote in there. Right. It says, you know, disco sucks and long live rock. I mean, that said it all for me right then.
Right.
And there was kind of a divide even in the rock world, you know, when, you know, I liked punk.
Yeah.
And I liked the new metal that I was discovering in high school, you know, Scorpions, Judas Priest.
Sure.
Things like that that were metal. And then I liked, you know, I loved the Ramones.
Sure.
So I'd had my Ramones glasses with my Scorpion shirt, and I'd walk through the school and be hated by everyone.
Nice.
You know, didn't fit in anywhere.
And the rock star was born.
Maybe. But, you know, rebellion started early. But I tell you, the crossing of those two musics made a lot of sense to me. So when I discovered Motorhead finally, that was kind of the ultimate. Like, okay.
There's a precedent.
I remember going to see Motorhead somewhere here in LA, and looking next to me, there's this guy with, you know, a pink mohawk and spikes.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here headbanging, and we're getting along.
Right.
It's like, all right, maybe we can kill disco together.
You could.
Yeah.
So that was it, huh? Motorhead was the bridge.
It really was. It really was the, you know, between the two. And I was trying to figure out, you know, where do I belong? Because, you know, I couldn't hang out with the rockers, couldn't hang out with the punk rockers either.
So. It's so weird to grow up when we grew up because, like, that weird era, that time in music, you know, outside of, like, the Scorpions, and you remember when Van Halen 1 came out?
Mm-hmm.
because we were like sophomores, and that like eruption, like out of every Camaro, out of those Jensen triaxles, was just that fucking solo, and you're like, what is that?
Dude.
Right?
It's
right?
Unbelievable. I still get blown away by that record.
Yeah.
It's so alive sounding, so fresh, and so just, it oozes of youth and just rebellion.
Yeah.
It sounds so great.
And it was fun. Yeah. That was the weird thing. There was no darkness in it. It was like, you know, like, because David Lee Roth was almost like a clown. And it was like, it was fun. It was like, it was almost like pop music, but they had this gnarly fucking guitar thing going.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it was. It was party. It was definitely party music.
And we were up against Foreigner. I mean, there was a lot of shit going on. Bob Seger. It was all, like, that whole fucking, it all happened when we were in high school. We were picking up like this crashing wave of the fucking 60s and 70s, and then it's just like an eruption of prog rock garbage happened.
Yeah.
Styx, Grand Illusion.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah. There's a good guitar sound on that one.
No. Can play. Yeah, on Renegade. Dun, 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 dun. That was all right.
Oh, the. Bam, bam.
Yeah, that's a good riff. Yeah, no, I'm not gonna take anything. But what's his name? Tommy Shaw and the Fellas.
Right.
No. I know we're all in the same world, but it was a weird time.
There was a lot of music to listen to, and a lot of different genres and whatnot going on, and. Yeah.
Supertramp.
My buddy was Kiss. I was Aerosmith. Yeah. My other buddy was Foreigner. He said, can't believe your favorite band is Foreigner.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah.
Feels like the first time.
Yeah. Again. Yeah. Whatever. It served its purpose.
Where does Sabbath fall in?
Oh, that was before any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
For you?
Yeah. Putting it on. Like I was telling you, my brother, he was older than I. Yeah. He had a turntable. He had all kinds of records. And when he would be at school or college or wherever he went, I was playing his albums, just soaking it in.
And he's so lucky. The big brother thing is like, you know, that's the gift.
Very
to,
cool.
To have the guide.
Yeah, Sabbath. Yeah. Sabbath, that first Sabbath record. I mean, I just looked at the cover and freaked out.
Yeah.
And then I started it, you know, and there's the rainstorm and, oh my God.
What's happening?
It scared me. And I loved every minute of it, man. So if it's going to scare me, it's definitely going to scare mom. Turn it up.
You're in your brother's room, I picture, just sort of like, I'll just try it. You're alone.
Oh, yeah.
What's happening?
Yeah. Oh, shit. Erase. Ah, I can't go back. Ah,
no, you know? Going back.
No going back. No now, going man. Back.
It's so weird because like I came to a lot of that stuff so much later and I had to appreciate it as a grown up. But like I fucking love that stuff now. Mm. Sabbath 4. What a great record that is.
Yeah, the Volume 4. So cool. So, I mean, there's so many great riffs and there's so much weird stuff on there too.
And you're a riff guy.
Oh man.
Like you're the riff.
Well,
I mean, in a way though, right? I mean, that's the.
Well, and there under that it says Riff Life. That
does it really?
Me. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Because that and Sabbath really kind of like that. That's what that's about.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
The song was the riff.
Right.
If you didn't have a good riff, it wasn't a great song.
Right.
Simple as that. And Tony Iommi, the riff master of all time, forever, and we all bow to him and try to be him.
And you've worked with him.
Yep.
Was it sure great have. When you first met him? Like, how, that must be the amazing thing, like, to grow up when we did and then to be playing with your heroes.
It is crazy. I've got plenty of pictures of me, you know, I got a picture of me standing next to Steven Tyler, meeting him for the first time.
Yeah.
And he's just like, hi. And I'm like, ah! Fanboy
right,
going
right.
nuts.
Yeah.
And same with Ted Nugent and same with Tony Iommi. He was the epitome of cool.
Yeah.
He's writing the ugliest, darkest riff ever.
Yeah.
And he's, hello, how are you?
Yeah.
Friendly, super nice guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So you and I have something in common, and it's fairly public and self-professed anger issues.
No.
Yes.
I do not.
Yeah. Not anymore.
Yeah.
All gone. But do you like, because like I was starting to think about the music and getting heady about it, about how, you know, when you're younger, you know, and the anger is actually active in the music, you know, it's relieving. And then like helpfully as you get older, you at least get that thing wrangled and you can draw from it a little more consciously and a little more like, you know, it doesn't have to drive you.
Right. I get what you're saying.
Yeah. And like, I can kind of feel that. They, like, you can still speak to it, but it has more range in a way because it's not crippling you.
Exactly. That's a great word, crippling.
Yeah.
Instead of crippling, it's just the, it's like the evil twin that's just sure. with you all the time.
Right.
But you know how to deal with it.
Right. When like, did it start revealing itself to you? You know, when you were younger, when did you like first realize you were pissed off? Was there an event?
I think it slowly built. I think religion was kind of the start of it.
That would Christian say. Scientists.
I didn't really believe what they were teaching me.
Yeah,
And it didn't work for me. It didn't make any sense.
Well, it's kind of a crazy. There's some parts of it that are crazy.
Yeah, like, yeah. Don't go to the doctor. Wait, don't. Don't go. Even if you were deathly ill, or like both my parents passed of cancer.
Yeah.
In front of me, that was probably the most angry I've been.
Like later in life.
No, I was 16 when my mother passed away. 13, I would say. Well, my parents met because of the church.
Yeah.
And my dad was the equivalent of a minister in the church.
Right.
So very active in it. And yeah, Sunday school was part of my regiment. And at that point in wherever we went, it wasn't really...
So were your brothers part of it too? I mean, like
they were already kind of... They were older enough to not...
Yeah. And it was just the three of you guys?
Yeah. I have a younger sister too.
Uh-huh.
So we'd be in Sunday school, and it wasn't fun. It wasn't like it was teeming with lots of youth and kids having fun, and you know, it was like being at school again, and oh, you got to learn this and learn this. At least that was my perception.
Yeah.
And later on, I kind of realized that was part of my dad's journey. You know, that was what helped keep him on the straight and narrow. But when he would talk to me, it would be in scripture, you know, I got a question about life, you know, okay, let's read about it.
Oh, Bible, really?
And that kind of thing.
And, yeah. And you're but wait, that doesn't help me. Should I fuck her?
Is that a yes or a no? Is that how do you put a rubber on? What is a rubber? Any of that stuff. I wasn't asking my dad stuff that.
Yeah.
But, whenever you did something wrong, that's what happened.
You went to scripture.
It kind of seemed like a punishment, you know.
Right. So there's no communication.
No, not at all. But that was his way of communicating. And I get it.
Now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because me being in recovery and, you know, having a certain language, you know, when my kids stumble across something and I just tell them a little story about me or something.
Right.
And they're like, Dad, we're not in therapy.
Yeah. You know?
Okay. Sorry. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. I'm doing it again.
Right.
Stop that.
Right.
You know, I'll just listen. I'll listen to you guys, you know?
Well, that's definitely something you learn in recovery. That moment when you're hearing someone's story and you get moved by it. Mm. Like that moment where I'm open about it. And you just brought it up, but I break that tradition is that, you know, what happened, what it was like, what happened and what it's like now, that structure. Mm-hmm. But that moment where they get sober and I'm always like, oh, good. You know, like it always gets me. And it taught me how to be empathetic.
Right. Yeah. That's something that I was lacking as well. It was kind of, I had to fight for what I could get, you know, and because I wasn't happy in the family, you know, I couldn't express my anger in a healthy way, even, you know, I couldn't go against because that would be really, really bad. Then I'd get double the scripture or whatever it was.
Right.
You know? And it felt really elite, like an eliteness, like we're better than other people because we believe this. Oh, they believe these lies and this and that. And so it was a little cultish, at least in my mind. I know there's plenty of people out there that, that religion in general works for them. I understand the concept of a higher power, and it does work for me.
Sure.
But religion itself fucked me up.
Right.
And especially that one when I was young. And
well, if you see your parents or family members get ill and refuse to see a doctor, just that element of it, I mean, that's like, it's beyond reason.
Yeah.
So the pain of that.
Well, a lot of things happened around that. You know, my father left when I was 13. Didn't say goodbye, didn't do anything, just took off. And, you know, that doesn't sound Christian to me. You know,
really?
What's going on here? You know,
No contact or?
About a year later.
Oh my God. Yeah. You're 13.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
And then my mom took it really difficult. You know, she was, you know, she all of a sudden had to start working. You know, she wasn't getting any money in. And so she went back to the art that she had done before and helped the family along as
good
as she
could. What kind of art?
She was a painter.
Oh, yeah.
But then interior design. She did logos, things like that, which kind of makes sense.
Like graphic design kind of stuff?
Yeah, graphic design. Yeah, exactly. And then, she got sick with cancer. And, you know, we watched her pass away in front of us, you know. And
no medicine.
No. The religion talks about, you know, if you acknowledge that you're ill, that's part of letting in, you know, the thing that will make you ill. So not so much, I guess, you know, it sounds like denial to me, but not allowing that truth in, you know, keeping a positive approach to it and
sure.
healing thyself and through the higher power and all that. And it didn't seem to be working.
You know? What barometer do they use to judge that as working after a certain, I would think that after a number of people pass away in a community, eventually you'd be like, yeah, maybe you'll go medicine. It's not
yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, at least what I believe now, and it's just what I believe.
Yeah.
It's not gospel whatsoever is, you know, higher power gave us knowledge on how to, help ourselves.
That's right.
Yeah. So that made sense to me. But, you know, her passing made me really pissed. Me really pissed.
At religion?
Yeah. Well, not just that, but at, my father leaving and, you know, causing that to happen. You know, I blamed that. And then what did I do wrong? What could I have done? You know, I'm the man of the house at 13 and, you know, just a lot of things that I had to work through.
Yeah, you had to excavate all that grief and anger, sad, absolutely. The pain.
Yeah, yeah.
Ugh.
Tons of it. And I tell you, music was the thing that's always where I would go. I could escape to that. It made me feel better. It made me... It was speaking the words that I didn't know how to say, and it was an escape. I could put the headphones on and be in a better place.
Sure. And when did the booze start?
Yeah, that started when I moved in with my brother
after your mom passed.
Yeah.
And your dad, did you resume communication with him, or
I was not in that place. Nah. I was not. My sister was. Yeah. And she was able to reconcile and go live with him. So through my half a junior and senior year, moved schools and lived with my brother. That's when the music really started kicking in.
Yeah.
And that's when I would go watch other musicians locally. And that's where, you know, first beers kind of showed up. Like, have a beer, you know. And then along with the smell of the burning amps and all of that stuff, the smell of the beer was also great.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just kind of fit in with everything, you know?
Yeah. And then the first band, how old were you?
Well, I was, that was probably my junior year. It was just before my mom passed.
Yeah.
I got in a band. It was called Obsession. And we've had a long list of cool cover songs that we were doing. You know, me and the Veloce brothers and a guy named Jim.
Yeah.
We were in their garage and in Downey.
Yeah.
And we would just play all night and have fun. We'd do Thin Lizzy songs, Robin Trower. We had Black Sabbath. UFO.
Yeah.
A huge list.
Good
we
list.
We had about 40 songs
that
we could play. We played maybe three parties max. But
not a dance band per se.
Not so much. It was hang around the keg and, you know, rock out.
Yeah, man. So now when you started, because it seems to me that like another question I had in listening to the record and listening to all this stuff is that there seems to be themes that move through metal and through your music, and like the sort of pushing back against dogma, religion, authority, and that stuff has always been a rebellious thing in rock and roll. But this comes from a specific experience that your distrust of religion and order.
Right, right.
And I think that you guys sort of established a lot of the themes, like, you know, despair, paranoia, insanity, like, you know. Yeah.
Well, yeah. All that fun stuff we all like to live in, and you know, I tell you what it is if I can get it out of my head,
yeah,
it makes it better.
Right,
and,
right.
And better out than in, because if I can put it into a song and question it, you know, I have no answers. I got a lot of questions. And actually, I think when someone identifies with your question, it's better than them telling you the answer, actually.
Right.
You know, I identify with that question. I don't know. Let's find out together, or yeah, let's just ponder it together.
Yeah.
You know, that's a higher power showing up, at least for me.
Yeah.
So when the fans understand that question as well, it makes me feel okay. And that's all I really kind of want.
Right.
Is to feel okay and feel validated and feel like I belong.
Yeah.
So that's what these lyrics do.
Isn't that funny, though, like about how, because my dad wasn't absent, but he was certainly detached, mm-hmm, and volatile.
That's absent. It is.
Yeah. I don't know that I've fully processed it.
Right.
You know, like that, the selfishness of it. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of like, you know, one way, you know, either, you know, if they're gone, they're gone. But then there's the other kind that sort of erase you,
yep,
while you're there.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. I mean, it's tearing you down.
Right.
It's not like, okay, they're not there. I'm starting to heal. I'm starting to process because it's not still happening.
Right. 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 Yeah, because they're just always there, and you're reacting to an absence, and then, or is probably a little different than reacting to, like, I don't know what he's going to do. What the fuck's going to happen?
Totally. Yeah. And living in it, you know, and it's not, you're not alone there, because I think a lot of that generation, gosh, it was kind of not, I don't want to say passive aggressive, but it was
aggressive, aggressive.
Yeah. Why am I laughing? I'm sorry for laughing.
No, it's
but yeah, you didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah,
that was the thing. You know, that you know, cliche. Wait till your father gets home. It's like,
right.
Oh shit! Nothing scared me more than that.
Right,
because he was the dealer of punishment.
Right,
you know, all the stuff that I had done throughout the day, Mom checked it off and wrote it down, and then handed it to him. And you know, what a fucking shitty job,
yeah,
to do. You come home after working your ass off and you get handed a list of all the shit that happened, and you gotta deal out some whatever,
right,
lashes with the belt or whatever, you know, in my case. So that sucked. I'm sure it sucked for him.
Yeah.
And it sucked for me.
Yeah.
And probably for my mom, because she couldn't deal with us. It's tough.
And I never got it together to have kids either, but I imagine, like, because my brother has three kids, I imagine that you, as a father, you've got to sort of approach this with sort of like, well, I don't have a template for this. I got no, they've got no good experience around this particular job. So you got to re-navigate.
Well, I have to ask questions. I got a lot of good buddies that,
oh, really?
You know, we're in the same boat.
Yeah.
And it's okay to ask for help. You know,
yeah,
it's like, man, my kid's doing this. What, you know,
what
have
you
ever
do?
Experienced that? And they're like, yeah. So there's good stuff like that I don't think my father did. You know, I don't think he sat around with his buddies going, gosh, my son's having trouble with, you know, math, and he's lashing out and this, you know. So I think the template that you talked about, I think I had a template of what not to do.
Right.
But I didn't really have the template of what to do.
Yeah.
So it was at least a good start.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to break this cycle. I don't want this happening. But I don't want to go the exact opposite way, which tends to happen as well. Yeah.
And how's it going?
It's going better.
How many you got?
kids?
Yeah.
I got three.
Oh, yeah.
Three beautiful children. Beautiful wife. We've been, you know, first and only wife, been married for over 19 years, and we've got an 18-year-old daughter who's in college now. I've got a 16-year-old boy who's completely awesome and
That's
very
cool.
expressive. I have a daughter, a younger daughter, who is 14, and, you know, she's a girl in high school, first year of high school, and there's a lot of questions, a lot of, you know, slow processing going on, and she's right in the middle of it.
Uh-huh.
But she is awesome. I have three healthy, beautiful, great kids.
Well, that's good. Congratulations.
Thank you.
But I imagine with that last one, it's a lot of like, well, maybe I ought to talk to your mom about that.
you know, she gravitates to me.
I mean, yeah?
There's something, I tell you,
yeah.
Between a father and a daughter, there's some magic.
Yeah.
Not that it isn't with my son, but
right.
He'll go to mom.
Oh, you know, really?
That's just kind of how it is, I think. I think that's supposed to be,
yeah.
I guess.
That's great.
But yeah, growing up, watching them learn and discover and love music their own way.
Yeah.
You know?
Are they introducing you to stuff?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whether I like it or not.
Right. Right.
Good stuff, bad stuff, and just out there stuff. And I love watching them enjoy music. That's the coolest thing.
Yeah.
Where they get so into it. And it's like, oh, man, that's what it's about.
Yeah.
I don't care what it sounds like, but look what it's doing to you.
Yeah.
That is cool.
And when you play now, I mean, like you said, when are you guys going on tour?
We kind of are already.
Yeah.
But it's, I don't know. It's this, like, it's slowly happening. But I think next year is when we really start touring.
And do you have to, like, get into shape?
Yeah, I have to.
Yeah? No, but I mean, like, I imagine it's quite a process for what you guys do.
Mental, physical, spiritual, all that.
Yeah.
Mind, body, yeah, got to get into shape. And because when you're out there, there's a lot of things coming at you. And, you know, at least for myself. You know, surround myself with people that get what I need.
Yeah.
You know, they're not yes men by any means. They call me out on shit, which I need.
You bring sober guys with you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I need that.
Yeah.
And I need someone on the tour where at 3 a.m. you can take a knock at the door and let me in.
Yeah, yeah.
And
like
not so much talk me off the ledge, but...
Yeah.
You know, what's going on?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm still up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's going on?
Yeah, you know,
I feel like doing this
because
I'm freaking bored or
whatever
it is.
Sure. Oh, no, absolutely, dude.
So age-appropriate touring for us looks like 2 weeks at a time.
Oh, yeah.
2 weeks out, 2 weeks at home.
Yeah.
You know, trying to balance
both
loves in our lives. And, you know, gosh.
How long you been married?
19 years.
So she went through all the shit with you?
Yep. She walked through fire right next to me.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I threw her in the fire a few times, too.
Well, yeah, how are you not going to do that?
Yeah.
Because that's what the brain does. Like, and I notice it even now. It's sort of like, I feel like shit. So now I'm just going to rope-a-dope her emotionally.
Mm.
You know, as she tries to help. And then you're just sort of like, nope, nope. And then when, right when they break, you're like, yeah, now look where we are.
Yay. Yeah. Look what I did to you too.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, man.
Yeah. Someone trying to help you and you making them think they're crazy.
Yeah.
You know, nope, I never said that, or I wasn't doing that, or no, don't know who she is.
Yeah.
No, I don't know whose bottle that is.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And they just take it until they can't. And I imagine you had that moment where you're like, this is all going to go. And then,
and that's the best thing that ever happened to me, I tell
right,
you.
Right, right.
When the you know, the two me's collided, you know, the road me and the home me collided, man, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And the most horrible feeling and, you know, now the best thing that ever happened.
Oh, good for you, man. Good for you. That's great.
Well, hats off to her because she put up with the shit, and she's been a good mentor for me in life too. She's very balanced, very even keeled, and it drives me nuts.
Yeah.
And you know, the opposites do attract, and at some point we just had to realize that, you know, we got to respect each other because we can help each other.
Sure.
Here. I can help you loosen up and be a little stupid, and you can help me get my shit together and be responsible.
Yeah. And obviously you had the love there that was deep enough to survive it.
Yeah.
That's the fucking beautiful thing.
For sure.
Yeah.
And then both our backgrounds, you know, not dissimilar, but
She comes from the shit.
Different.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, kind of invisible kid.
Yeah.
You
know, yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Invisible kid and not really cared for.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. So it matched up. And once you get healthy together. It works out.
Yep.
It's that weird challenge of, like, you know, kind of like having to impress this father that stinks in your head. Like, it's fucking ridiculous.
Every man has that. It's so weird.
I used to do a joke about it. It was never got a laugh. I used to say, I think that every father-son relationship on some level is a battle to the death.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know?
And until you both die, it's going to go on.
You know? That's right. You get to a certain age where you're like, you better go first.
Yeah.
It's so dark.
Oh, it's crazy. I tell you, I still battle with him. You know, it's dumb. Voices appear in my head, and it's like, wait, who's that?
You really?
Who's talking to me?
You
right
got to separate them out.
Oh, yeah.
Does that come into the songwriting at all?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's again, part of the therapy of music for me.
And have you made all your amends from
sure.
the past?
Again and again and again.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think I'm pretty clean.
Yeah?
I think I'm pretty clean right now, but, you know, there's always something.
I talked to you. You know who I had in here? I had Scott Ian in here.
Awesome.
He's a sweet guy.
Oh, he's awesome.
You know, and I had to load up on that metal, you know?
He's quite a character, man.
Yeah, and a sweet guy.
Oh, man.
Very earnest dude. You know what I mean?
He's very down to earth.
Yeah.
He loves his music. He knows a lot about it, and he's got a great memory and a lot of cool stories.
He spoke so highly of that I guess you guys did some things together, the Big Four.
Yeah.
And like he was like, it was almost like moved me to tears when he was talking about the, you know, it was, who was it? You, Anthrax, Megadeth, and Slayer.
Yep.
And you're all backstage together. And he had this moment where like, it teared me up a little bit that you guys were like, you could all be in your own success and be together and it'd be all right.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
And the fact that, you know, it blew my mind. It really started with the kind of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction idea. And,
yeah.
You know, getting nostalgic.
Yeah.
You know, and thinking, my God, look at all the people that have helped us along the way and look who are still around.
Yeah.
Let's say thank you to them. And so the Big Four was kind of that thing.
Yeah.
We're all still playing after 30, whatever it was, 32 years. Let's go do a gig together. I mean, why shouldn't we? Let's celebrate the fact that we're still alive and playing music that we love.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the other thing was the new wave of British heavy metal. That's all I ever hear about.
Yeah.
No album, the blah, blah, blah. You know, what about the Big Four?
Yeah.
No one knows the Big Four. Come on, let's make it known.
Yeah.
Let's make some history here and let people know and put a mark there that the Big Four was and... you know, is a force to be reckoned with.
And he delivered the goods.
Yeah, we loved it. We had a blast.
And Mustaine and you guys are good?
Yeah, there's no reason to not be good.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
At this point, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we've all friggin' fell off the wagon. We've all gone into the ditch. We've all got back on track. And we've all learned from our stuff. And at the end of the day, it's just journeys. Everyone's doing a different journey. And why would you hold a grudge with someone or vice versa, you know?
And you all been through tragedies. Like you got real rock and roll tragedies. You lost a Cliff and all that stuff and your own accidents and shit. I mean, you guys really lived the life. And I imagine when you survive it at a certain point, all whatever that personal bullshit is got to fall away.
I've seen some kind of light around that because I think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was a part of that realization that, you know, when we were up there and seeing, you know, Ozzy is sitting at one table
shaking.
And the rest of Black Sabbath at the other table and they don't want to jam together and they're being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So we go up and we play a song. We play Black Sabbath songs for them.
Yeah.
And that was beautiful for us.
Yeah.
But it was sad to see that. I'd rather see you guys play. You know, whatever it is.
Oh, yeah, they can't get past
it. Put it away, please. I get it. I get it's hard to get past stuff, but there's stuff in my life I thought I could never get over.
Like what?
Oh, just fights with Lars about shit. And, you know, we're brothers, you know?
Right.
And I'm thinking, you know, this is it. No friggin' way I'm doing, you know, I can't get past this. I can never look at him again. And then a month later, you're writing Hardwired together, you know, and you're making the best record of your life. It's like, dude, it works. All right. Just see past that shit. Go big picture. Whatever it is you need to do, you can get past the most unbelievable places that you know, you think you can never get out of.
Well, it's a choice, right?
Right, right.
That's the weird thing that you realize.
And my wife will tell me that it's a choice. She'll say, hey, you know, I'll it's over. Forget it. Yeah. I can't work together. And she'll go, yeah, yeah. Mm, okay. You know,
yeah.
You say that now.
Yeah.
And no. This is it. I feel it. This is, I can't get over this. And it's unbelievable what you can get over. So seeing that, or like the Van Halens up there, or the, you know, Blondie had a moment where it was like, oh my God. Or, you know, you look at like Roger Waters and,
I just talked to him.
Oh, come on, you guys, you know, beautiful music.
And you know, you feel it too, dude, when you're sitting there with them and just like you now, when you have that moment where you're like, no, like on some level, cause we're men, all we want to do is just cry. You know, it's a sadness, like it's like almost childish.
Very, yeah.
And like, you know, if we just fucking bawled a minute quietly, it'd be all right.
Yeah.
It's like holding on to this. It's a sad sort of like childish thing, man.
You're stuck in that moment of that, and you're reliving it. That's resentment, and you just can't. But if you know what works for me with Lars, we just sit down and just start talking about our kids. That's where we'll start. Uh-huh. And that's a completely loving place to start.
Right.
We'll talk about that. And then all of a sudden, it's like, fuck, dude. You know, I'm sorry. I did this. And that.
Yeah,
And then all of a sudden, you're back.
Right there.
Boom, like that. Like a guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, ego deflated.
That's
done,
right.
Out of the way. Fear done. Out of the way. And now you can move on.
Well, what are, because I always wonder that about bands, because I know that the relationship has to get strained, but even when I saw Deep Purple inducted and Richie's not, you know.
Right.
It's like, what? Why? Yeah. What could be the fucking, at this age?
Right.
You know? But like, I guess these are, it's emotional. It's not creative.
Right.
Right.
Man, it is such a wall. It's such a block. It's such a uncreative thing, you know, to be
right.
Stuck in that prison of resentment, you know? The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it's not like you're being led into heaven or something.
Right, right.
It's just an acknowledgement of your stuff that you've done together, but the fact that you can't be there for that at the same time is sad.
It is sad, right?
Yeah.
Let's get back to music for a minute, because I wanted to talk about the role of a producer. I talked to Keith Richards about Jimmy Miller. Like, there's a shift. Like, the Black Album was a shift for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. With the producer,
definitely.
And like, who was producing before? Was it you guys? I mean, like, who was like, what was the big change that you had to open yourself up to when you make a decision to change your sound in a way?
Yeah, I think it was us driving the boat there. Fleming Rasmussen, who worked on the first albums, except Kill 'Em All, he was the engineer that could get sounds. He was,
right.
You know, a semi-producer.
Right.
You know, he'd say, not so good. You know?
Right.
And we were, okay, well, fuck you.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
We were driving that ship until, you know, in Justice for All, we realized that, you know, we need some help.
Yeah.
The album doesn't sound great. Songs are good, but, you know, we're mixing this record as we're on the Monsters of Rock tour. Our ears are blown out.
Right.
We can't decide what sounds good and doesn't anymore.
Yeah.
So after that, we decided we need some help.
Yeah.
We need a producer. And that's when Bob Rock came into the picture.
And he was like a kind of a guy who dealt with the type of music you guys respected.
Yeah, you know, we liked his sounds. That was the main thing.
You know, you actually have, like, there's a physical, even if you're in your car, like, the Metallica music, it's like, it's hitting you.
That's the best place.
Yeah.
In a car.
Yeah, the best.
That's the best place to listen to music in general.
Yeah,
really.
Because you're like, you're a hero.
Yeah.
You're like, you know, it's like.
Oh, you're in it.
Yeah.
You're living in, you know, it's in a space.
Yeah.
But there's not, you know, it doesn't have to be anyone else in it.
That's,
you know?
Right. The best time.
You're on stage right in there, no
exactly.
Matter what you're playing. Yeah.
But did he, like, how did he work? Like, what was it that.
I was able to explain to him what I was after.
Yeah.
And he was able to get that, put it into whatever knob language.
Right.
Know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But for me, I knew what sound I wanted, and I've always been chasing it. And I still am. You know, the next record's going to sound better. I'll tell you.
The one after the one you just put out?
Exactly. That one's going to have a better guitar sound.
Yeah.
It is. Because, you know, as a riff guy, it's like I'm chasing the unreachable sound, probably.
Yeah.
But all those records coming up to then, I was trying to get what I wanted, and he helped me get it a little more.
Right.
So the layering, I mean, the harmonies, and vocally for sure, that's when I think Bob Rock really, really helped me is in the vocal department. You know, no one ever before would say, you know, that doesn't sound very good, or how about trying this, or
yeah,
that word doesn't sing right.
You know? Right.
Yeah, how about this harmony? Try this. And so I remember when he said, okay, at the end of this part, while there's a guitar solo going on, just throw a couple ad-libs out there. It's like, what? What's that? You mean like, you know,
talking,
come on, baby, or something, you know, what am I supposed to say?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that was when I realized, man, you're kind of closed-minded here. You need to kind of open up a little bit. And, you know, like I think the end of Sandman was the thing, you know, often never land, doing, you know, just some things that kind of tail off and, you know, just be loose. Like you're, you know, playing live or something, you know? Okay, now I get it.
So, yeah.
I mean, I think everyone that we've worked with has tried to get us to sound like we do live, you know?
Yeah. Right. Well, that's it. That's the big business, the live.
Yeah. Well, trying to, I don't know if it's actually, you know, mistakes and all, but that feeling of it's on, you know, you're gelling, everything is electric.
Right.
And trying to recreate that in the studio is not super easy, especially when you're working in there for over a year, you know?
Right, exactly. And a lot of times you're not there at the same time, I imagine, or you're doing tracks on overdubbing and whatever. Like, you're not in the room together. And I know people record like that, but it's must be sort of a chore.
Yeah, well, we do that. You know, we write and record the basic tracks all together. And on this record, especially, you know, having Greg there at the beginning, we were able to get great sounds. Greg Fiddleman, the producer, along with Lars and myself. He was able to get great sounds at the beginning.
Yeah.
Because we did it at HQ, which is our home sanctuary.
And it's your label, right?
Right.
Yeah.
In America, it is. So everything we played was album quality.
Right.
So there are guitar tracks on there that were first, second, third take, possibly. Some are overdubs, some are not, you know. So it was just a newer and different way. That's probably the most different on this album compared to the other
albums. In terms of working?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, when you look out at the crowd now, like, who do you see? You see guys our age? Young guy? Like, what's
I do. I see guys our age. I see guys older. I see, you know, what blows my mind is I see young girls in the front.
Yeah.
You know, and they're in the front. Yeah. I remember, you know, when I'd go to any gig, there's no way girls were, they weren't even near the front.
Right.
Because it was too brutal.
Right.
But I tell you, whether it's how they do the barricades now or whatnot, and we have our own special way, but it's less brutal. So you get all kinds up there. I mean, I see father, sons up in the front and daughters. And
right.
It's anybody and everybody. Everybody is certainly welcome. And no one, there's not like a, you know, it used to be, here's your dress code, show up, and that's that.
Right.
But now.
Loosened up a little.
A little bit, you know. You got, you know, guys just come off of work and they're whatever, still got their handcuffs on their briefcase, you know.
Yeah.
And they're at the gig, and you've got guys that, you know, just whatever, just walked in from the, you know, at the auto shop, and you've got kids and grandpas and three generations of people showing up.
That's how long you've been at it. That's great.
Beautiful.
It is.
It is super beautiful. And what I get to do from up there is look out and watch these people enjoy the music and see how they react. How are they taking this in? And why the hell do you like this song? Really? You know, we're playing Master of Puppets and you're a little girl out there going, Master! You know, what is it? What is it for you? And it doesn't matter. She's there and she's enjoying it.
But you do ask those questions?
I do all the time. Are you sure you like this? Someone's just fucking with us. I know it. I'm going to wake up and this is all going to be a huge punk.
Oh, that's interesting,
James Hetfield, you've been punked.
Well, that's but that's the thing about the lyrics and the way you write, and the, when you talk about questions and about how much of the stuff is almost a call and response to, you know, these... The, you know, those feelings, that, you know, that they may be more present when you're younger, but they don't go away. Right. And certainly if you grew up with them, with you guys, and now that you have kids and stuff, you know, those feelings, you revisit them in almost a fun way.
Right.
Like, you know, I remember when I wanted to kill everybody. Yeah, that was, when I was your age, I wanted to just kill. And
yeah.
Now it's just fun.
Now I only want to kill half the people. That's progress, dude. That's awesome.
I would love to see like a father and son at your show. That must be really kind of touching.
Oh, it's super cool.
Yeah.
It's super cool. And of course, you know, the kid gets showered with gifts of picks and drumsticks and sweatbands and here you go, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I, here's Kirk's guitar. Yeah, I'll give it to him.
He's got another one.
Wait. Yeah.
What was the, you did that album with Lou, right?
Yeah.
Like, how did, like, you know, that was an interesting thing. You know?
It was very interesting, no doubt.
Because, you know, like, he's definitely, like, it makes sense, you know, for him. And I just wonder, how did that come to happen?
It made sense for us, too.
Yeah?
At the beginning, it was, I mean, just jamming with anybody, recording with someone else, that was weird.
Like, and it's Lou Reed.
What do you mean, you know? And, you know, our management is in New York.
Yeah.
We went, I don't know what, I can't remember what we were doing. I think it was it was, celebrating 25 years of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We were hosts of one night and we were picking out artists that had been in the rock or in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and played. And Lou Reed was there and from down the hallway, he yelled, "Hey, Metallica, I love you guys. We should do an album together one day." And we're like, yeah, okay, cool.
All
cool
right, see Lou. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Lou. Yeah, have another one.
Yeah.
And then we get a call from management, you know, saying, "Hey, Lou's serious. He wants to do an album." And we didn't know what to think about it. It's like, all right, what's he got in mind? You know, what they thought, could be a really cool idea.
You did Sweet Jane live, right? Was that what you played live? With him, like on that show, the award show that you're talking about? Didn't you jam with him somewhere? Or
yep,
am I making that
exactly?
Up?
No, that is true. That's true.
Was it Sweet Jane?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah,
and so that's where it came from,
right?
And he was he came to us basically with lyrics from a play that he had written. He had all these intense lyrics.
Yeah,
so this was a first for us to sit and write music behind a set of lyrics,
right?
Because that's not how we operate.
Yeah,
but it was really cool, and it was you know, it was definitely a in the studio jam kind of feel.
Uh-huh.
And Lou was from that school,
right?
That ilk of, you know, back in the 60s or 70s, you jammed it, you recorded it, and then you're done.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
"Hey, let's try that again." "Nope." It's like, "I just did it." Like, okay, I get it.
You know? Right.
Lou has spoken. We're done.
It's an interesting album. It's a good record.
I think it's super interesting.
Yeah.
And as a standalone piece in our career, I think I'm super grateful that we got to do it. At Lou and his that time of life, you know, we learned a lot from him.
Yeah.
He's a pretty, pretty cool guy. And let me tell you, if you know, rock and roll rebelliousness, was in him.
What'd you learn
about it?
Like in the sense of, like, what'd you take away from it? Because I'm a huge Lou Reed fan.
Well, yeah, the, "Hey, I sang it."
Yeah.
"That's a moment."
Yeah.
"I can't do that again." He would say that.
Yeah.
"I can't do that again."
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you're like, what?
Is that okay? Is that okay to do that? He just left, you know? Wow, okay.
So being in the moment.
Very much in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, what else? Oh, when you're doing interviews.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, when the interviewee starts asking questions, look out.
Yeah.
And especially if it's Lou Reed, because, man, he tore some people apart.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
He you know, he definitely had some trust issues. He didn't trust a lot of people, so he would grill you until you crumbled, and then he could trust you.
Right. This is like that dynamic we were talking about earlier, where you're like, get down to my level.
Exactly.
Like, I want to see you a little weaker.
Yeah.
You're a little too cocky right now.
Very true.
Uh-huh.
Very true. But he was a real honest guy.
Yeah.
A real honest guy. And I really appreciate the fact that he got us out of our little box of metal, you know?
Yeah. Were you, did you take his music into consideration ever earlier? Were you a fan?
No. I wasn't. I know Cliff Burton was certainly a fan. Yeah. Velvet Underground.
Oh yeah.
Cliff liked a lot of crazy psycho stuff.
Yeah. He seemed like a pretty special guy.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, look, man, I hope I did all right.
You did awesome. I didn't ask you any questions, did I?
Well, you know, it's funny because like some guys like, I just like to have a conversation, you know, but like I had Neil Young in here and, you know, I was just wrestling with like, you know, what am I going to start with? You know, I like Neil Young, but you know, when you have a musician over, you know, especially at a certain age, you know those five records,
right,
but then there's
right.
50.
Yeah.
And then you're like, what am I going to fucking do?
Yeah.
So like I... you know,
I love that because I totally get you.
Yeah. Yep. But like, I figure like I got this little 58 Fender Deluxe amp here and I know he plays through things like that.
Yep.
So I'm like, I'm going to start with gear and we'll just open it up and we'll see where it goes. And he gets in here and I basically go like, yeah, it's a 58 Deluxe. I think you play with one of those. And he looks over, he goes like, nah, I don't know. I guess. And I'm like, no. And
I guess.
Well, I knew he like, knew. He was doing that thing though. He was like, I'm gonna break him a little bit. And then like something happened and it was like, I don't know if it was an interview or what, but he was having a great time. And a lot of times with these things, people who are fans of people, you know, they already know everything. Hmm. So if they can just hear the guy as the guy,
yeah,
they're like, hey, Neil does Pilates? You know, like that? <And they're> doing, you know, that's the thing.
Really?
He does.
Yeah.
He brought that up.
Wow.
How long you got sober?
15.
Wow.
Days? No.
Oh, geez.
Years.
Yeah.
Yes.
It feels good, right?
Don't even joke about that.
No, you yeah. can't, right?
15 years. Oh, it feels great.
Good.
It feels
man.
Really good. Well, and it's a daily thing.
The daily reprieve.
Absolutely.
One day at a time.
Loving it.
Yeah, good, man. And again, like I love the new record, and I liked listening to the old records. It was great talking to you.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
See that? I think we covered some stuff, found some commonality, worked it out. Again, the new Metallica record, Hardwired Self-Destruct, available now. I'd like to thank James for coming by. It was fun. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Sorry, no guitar playing. I'm waiting for my flap to take on the tip of my finger. Boomer lives!